I've been approached by quite a few people, actually a startling number of people that have either known someone who's going through breast cancer treatment. I've met people that have been dying of breast cancer, and it's just prompted me to bring this subject up again. I believe we have spoken about it in the past, but this month's show will be about breast cancer awareness and prevention. I don't think we want to necessarily dwell on the treatment, although we will mention those alternative medical treatments that are available and are showing pretty good promise for inhibiting estrogen, for example, with the aromatase inhibitors. But the prevention of it, I think, is the fundamental key to good health. And so we put people's diets and lifestyles in the right place to begin with. That preventive strategy is probably a better payoff. Okay, so you're listening to Ask You, Dr. KMUD 91.1 FM. We're very pleased to welcome Dr. Pete to the show this evening and have his expertise with us. If you live in the area, the 923 number is 923-3911. Or if you're outside the area, as a lot of people who call in do seem to be outside the area, there's a toll-free number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. Or you can alternatively just go ahead and use the 707 area code. So that would be 707-923-3911. So just a very brief introduction for myself. My name is Andrew Murray. I graduated in England with a master's degree in herbal medicine. Came to California with my wife, Sarah, who's very pleased to have on the show again this evening. Sarah?
Good evening. My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray, and I'm delighted to be on the show talking about ways to help prevent breast cancer.
Okay, so we run a clinic in Garberville where we see patients with a wide range of conditions, treat them with herbal medicine and dietary advice, as well as consult with people nationwide. Okay, so Dr. Pete, are you on the other line?
Yes, here I am.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the show. As always, I want to make sure people get an introduction from you about your academic and professional background before we get into tonight's subject.
Okay. I'm a biologist, a PhD from the University of Oregon, specializing in physiology, and especially related to aging and reproductive hormone issues.
Okay, excellent. So for tonight, if not as always, it's a speciality that you have, given that reproductive hormones are surrounding the picture of tonight's topic on breast cancer. So looking at some articles that I was reading earlier on today, I think most people will recognize breast cancer awareness and the numbers of people that die from breast cancer as being fairly staggering. And I saw an article that was saying it was the leading cause of cancer death among women worldwide. What's your opinion of the causes of breast cancer in the first place, and how does this differ from the medical interpretation?
The animal studies have been pretty clear for almost 100 years that it is a matter of an estrogen-like irritation, if not exactly estrogen in the narrowest sense, but the main carcinogenic substances, such as in smoke and tar, are estrogen-like in their structure and effect. So the breast is very sensitive to an imbalance of estrogen-like stimulation. So it's susceptible to anything that has an estrogen-like effect, including smoke and pollutants of various sorts.
Is this down to the fact that the estrogen receptors are most concentrated in the breast tissue, or that some other reason?
Every cell has estrogen receptors, but the way they interact with other functions, I think, is more important than the number of receptors, because once you're exposed to estrogen, a cell will produce more and more receptors. And progesterone has a very central function of destroying estrogen receptors. So a breast that's well balanced and exposed to enough progesterone won't have very many estrogen receptors during the progesterone dominance.
Interesting. So you said that the actual exposure to estrogen will cause an upregulation in the expression of estrogen receptors.
Yeah, pretty much in any cell. And irritation in general will do that. A failure of energy combined with stimulation will make estrogen receptors start to appear. So that old people, as the energy production decreases, any irritation tends to induce estrogen production as well as sensitivity by the receptors.
So interestingly, you're talking about the causal link, if you like, or the link between estrogen and irritation and stresses. And I think later on, I just want to bring out some more questions surrounding HRT and that kind of thing and estrogen replacement therapy. And I know when we've talked about many different subjects, you do bring up estrogen as being a causative factor in a lot of inflammation and irritation, and saying at this point in time that estrogen can be directly responsible for cancers.
The animal studies in the 30s and 40s were very clear that it isn't just the normally responsive tissues like the uterus and the breast that will cancerize under the influence of estrogen and similar things, but those are just the most sensitive. And with increased uninterrupted exposure to estrogen, sequence tends to go first cancer of the uterus, then cancer of the breast, then of the lungs, kidneys, intestine and liver, and brain.
Are you talking about primaries now or metastases?
No, primary.
Right, cancer. Okay.
Any tissue that is de-energized and irritated will develop not only the ability to respond to estrogen, but actual ability to make estrogen. So your fat or your skin or your liver can become a source of estrogen in proportion to how much stress you're under, even if you don't have ovaries.
Go on. I was going to cover the subject. I'll try and remember the subject. I wanted to ask a question about fat and conversion to estrogen. Go ahead.
So it's not just our a monthly cycling that's exposing women to estrogen. Estrogen is so prominent in foods and in our environment, increasingly so with our degradation of the environment.
The irritation, the fat is particularly sensitive to it. It isn't very well supplied with defensive and energetic systems, and so it seems to be our major age-related source of estrogen, especially if you're overweight.
Interesting. Okay, so I think that's a subject that should be brought out a little more. So fats in their own right, and at this point in time, are we talking polyunsaturated fats or fats in general?
That was just your normal, ordinary fat cells, but since the polyunsaturated fats increase the deposition and storage of fat, and since they break down to form the inflammation-promoting prostaglandins, they make the fat cells more likely to produce excess estrogen.
Hmm. Do you think there's any strategy to be benefited by the, because I know you mentioned too about increasing the dominance in the body of saturated to unsaturated fat by avoiding the polyunsaturates, and ultimately over 3 or 4 years, you say that essentially the body fat composition could be turned back to a more saturated type fat if you avoid the polys and
There's a thing called the saturation index, which is just the ratio between a saturated fat like stearic acid and a polyunsaturated such as linoleic acid. And people with cancer have a higher polyunsaturation, saturation index.
But you're saying a saturated fat cell is still capable of producing estrogen?
The cell which is more saturated is stabler and less likely to produce estrogen. But the more highly polyunsaturated fats are very closely connected with estrogen, so that the amount in the tissue and in circulation of a 5 or 6 unsaturated fats, such as you find in fish oil, mm-hmm. and you produce with aging, these are closely associated with the level of estrogen stimulation.
So eating nuts and seeds that are high in those polyunsaturated fats and fried foods that are fried in those corn and canola oil is going to be more promoting than an estrogenic fat. And
yes, for 80 or 90 years, about every 10 or 15 years, someone has done a study showing that the more polyunsaturated fat in the diet, the higher the cancer incidence. All the way down to extremely rare cancer incidents when there's no polyunsaturated fat in the diet.
Well, good. I was really just hoping that this show would just highlight again the importance of what you've been mentioning for many years now about improving your saturated fat intake and being very aware of the sources of polyunsaturates, both in pre-made foods as well as foods that you may choose to be cooking with. And that the ramifications have a pretty wide cause and effect associated with them. And cancer obviously is one of those effects of decreasing energy to promote suitable responses. And that, because of its thyroid suppressing effects, that is a direct relationship between low energy and the ability for systems to lose their correct structure and organization in terms of doing the right thing.
One of the diet factors that shows up repeatedly in association with a low rate of cancer is a high fruit intake, and fruit eaters getting the carbohydrate and the sugar produce saturated fats of their own, so they keep a relatively high saturation index in their tissues.
Excellent. Okay, good. Well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMU DeGarbo, 91.1 FM. This evening's topic is breast cancer. And if we do get any callers here between 7:30 and 8, it would be good if we can try and stay on the topic that we're discussing. Dr. Pete, HRT, as it's always mystified me how HRT's carried on for such a long time. I know they're just talking about it recently, that it's maybe not the best thing for women. Now they're finally saying that, like they are admitting that saturated fats are actually better for you than our polys. But HRT is a concept. how do you think it came to a position where estrogen was such a promoted, supposedly beneficial for your bones, to help with things like age-related dementia, memory loss? And it's actually the opposite. You have plenty of evidence to show that it's completely opposite to that. It's actually not good for your bones, and it's actually increases the chances of dementia.
So there is a very good essay on the internet. I think it's still available, a Harvard Law School paper by Carla Rothenberg on the history of hormone replacement therapy.
Carla Rothenberg?
Rothen, R-O-T-H-E-N-B-E-R-G.
B-E-R-G, okay. Carla Rothenberg, okay.
And it gives the political economic history of how the 12 big estrogen companies in 1942 got together to basically take over the FDA, medical journals, and universities to indoctrinate the idea that estrogen was the female hormone that would promote fertility and all the good female virtues, even though it went absolutely against the research of the 1930s, which showed that progesterone was the essential female hormone that promoted fertility and good pregnancy success.
Wow.
Well, I mean, they knew back in the 1800s that the chimney sweeps would die of
testicular cancer.
Yeah, testicular cancer from the estrogenic effects of the soot.
Yeah, but this was all turned around by these 12 giant companies getting together to promote the idea of the estrogen as the beneficial female hormone. And so they came on the market with the idea that I think it was a Harvard husband and wife pair of doctors that promoted the idea that you should give pregnant women estrogen to prevent miscarriage. And that produced the generation of DES babies, two generations, actually. Their daughters also were susceptible to cancer. And after the news got out by the late 50s that estrogen was not good for preventing miscarriage, they came out with the contraception idea. They knew in the 30s that estrogen causes miscarriages and abortion, and so they sold it for the opposite as long as they could get away with it, then came out on the market to sell it to prevent or interrupt pregnancies.
Wow.
So a lot of contraceptive pills allow pregnancy or fertilization to occur, but inhibits implantation. Is that correct?
My thesis advisor, Arnold Soderwall, did some very clear research on that, showing that a small amount at the time of just before implantation would prevent implantation, but a slightly larger amount after implantation had occurred would cause it to be ejected. And he made a graph showing that at each stage of pregnancy, just slightly increasing the dose of estrogen would cause miscarriage, all the way from preventing implantation to aborting it at any stage. It would cause the embryo to die and simply be resorbed.
Oh, it's incredible. It's like another worldwide, I don't know, we're going to call it brainwashing. I don't know what it is. I think it's so commonly repeated. These different topics are so commonly repeated by broad stream media. And those in, for want of a better word, power, the doctors, for example, who are looked up to and respected by most people that go to see them, for their education and their prowess, if you like, I don't know, that I just find it so, so incredible that there's evidence out there to show the opposite. In very many cases, it takes such a long time to make an impression, for it to get enough groundswell for the tide to get turned on this kind of thing. I mean, estrogen has been, ever since I can remember, has been the beneficial female hormone, and HRT, and my mum was on HRT, and I know all these other women on HRT, and it's probably one of the worst things you can do.
Several years ago, someone did a survey of the publications just in the Journal of the American Medical Association in the first years after the industry got this conspiracy together. They found that 200 different health conditions had been published in that one journal as treatable or curable or preventable by estrogen.
Oh my goodness.
Of those 200 turned out to be false.
Oh, my goodness.
The quantity and quality of the fraud is just
staggering.
Hard to understand.
Staggering. Now, didn't...
Well, it's all marketing, marketing, marketing.
Yeah. Well, what I wanted to ask you is, I think I remember hearing something like the only thing, I've not heard you say that just a moment ago, unless I've got it round the wrong way. I thought the only really only beneficial thing that estrogen was used for was really for getting pregnant. But you're saying that actually estrogen at this time of preconception or post conception would actually abort the fetus?
Soderwall was probably the most concise in his experiments in showing that it was exactly a dose relationship.
Wow.
And you could shift that dose relationship by increasing either the amount of progesterone or vitamin E as antagonists to that. My dissertation showed that that interaction worked through the availability largely of oxygen. Estrogen cuts off the availability of oxygen to the embryo, making the uterus short circuit, burn up, in effect, the oxygen before the embryo gets it. And progesterone and vitamin E both improve the delivery or preservation of oxygen for the...
Could you just repeat the name of the author again? I wouldn't mind taking a look at if I can find out this information myself. What was the name of the author of that...
Arnold Soderwald.
Soderwald. How do you... S-O-D-E-R?
S-O-D-E-R-W-A-L-L.
And didn't you say A-L-L?
Okay, well, got it. All right.
Didn't you say, Dr. Pete, that they didn't promote progesterone for all these 200 different diseases because it's so expensive to manufacture and estrogen is so cheap to manufacture, and they wanted to make more money off the estrogen?
More than that, it was that they knew in the 30s someone simply put a glass plate in the smoke of a candle and then extracted the soot and found that they had a whole variety of chemical substances, soot essences, which were estrogenic as well as carcinogenic. And so they understood that there was an infinite opportunity for having a patentable specific estrogen that you could market as your own product. But anytime you change the molecule of progesterone, you decrease or destroy its effect.
Right.
Huh. And so all those synthetic progestins actually have an estrogenic effect.
Yeah, because progesterone, part of its effect is what it turns into, and the additives attached to the progesterone molecule specifically block its conversion into that natural range of, of other steroids. And since the brain is a major source and user of progesterone, probably the worst effect of the synthetic progestins is that they interfere with brain
function. Oh my gosh.
So here's a hormone that helps breast cancer patients, helps pregnancies,
pro-life.
Just has all these pro-life wonderful effects.
Anti-inflammatory.
And they can't patent it because it's a natural hormone. So it's not promoted and it's not sold readily available.
Marion Diamond, a professor at University of California, did studies on animals showing that estrogen in pregnancy stops the growth of the brain, especially the cortex, makes it thinner and smaller. Progesterone increases the growth, especially of the cortex of the brain, making it bigger, more intelligent, and less psychopathic. And Catherine Dalton, working in England with her human patients, found accidentally the same thing turning out, that the women who were having pregnancy difficulties before treatment, their older kids averaged below 100 IQ. Once she treated them and prevented their toxemia of pregnancy, the kids averaged over 130 IQ.
Wow.
And isn't it quite expensive for companies to manufacture pure bioidentical progesterone?
Well, not compared to what drugs generally cost.
Right.
But, well, I mean, the raw material, if you compared raw material for estrogen, if it's just soot.
Yeah, you can get a 1,000 doses of estrogen for $1 and only a few doses of progesterone for $1.
So that it just all comes down to the dollar,
yeah,
the money.
I wanted to very quickly bring, I think we have a caller on the line, but we'll take that in a moment here. I just wanted to bring out this thing before we would move on to strategies to help women especially, because men do get breast cancer, but the numbers are fairly low, but women especially, to improve their odds of not getting cancer by avoiding all those things, Dr. P, that you're going to bring out from stress and its related effects with estrogen and everything else. That tamoxifen was a drug that was used to treat breast cancer, actually promoted endometrial cancer and thromboembolic events in so many people that it was given to. And
liver tumors and eye damage.
Okay.
And you mentioned that it's actually an estrogenic drug itself, very powerful estrogenic drug.
Just talk about that a little.
It's less powerful than estradiol, and so it can protect against the overproduction of estradiol, but in itself it's estrogenic.
Yeah. Incredible. Okay, well, let's take this caller and see where we're going with this. Hello, caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Hi, from Kansas City.
Hey, you're on the air. Go ahead.
In last month's interview on urea, Dr. Pete mentioned that up to 120 grams per day, 15 grams at a time, for getting rid of excess water. When you said excess water, what were you referring to exactly?
That's interesting in relation to estrogen because within about 5 minutes of an exposure to estrogen, cells begin to take up a lot of water. And that excess water stimulates cell division and growth. And that's part of the process of promoting cancer growth is to keep them in an excited inflammatory state of too much water, which keeps them from differentiating and functioning, but makes them able to keep dividing. And so the one of the principles of cancer treatment should be looking at the body's water economy.
One other question on that was, so how long or how often for the 120 grams of urea per day to actually have that benefit?
A Greek doctor, Danopoulos, was using urea in various forms, injecting it right into tumors, for example, also giving it intravenously. And it can be applied in crystal or solid form to an open superficial tumor. It's a very strange material because it doesn't destroy tissue when it, even in a pure crystalline concentrated form. And the injecting of 50% solution or a concentrated solution is possible if it goes in slowly. But people are used to thinking of an osmotic effect from a concentrated crystalline material, but urea isn't an osmolite. It has a very strange interaction with water. It can go into cells freely, just like the water. So what it's doing to remove excess water from cells isn't osmotically drawing out the water. It's doing something, adjusting the structure of the cell so that it doesn't have that excited need to retain water. And the typical intravenous dose would use a 30% solution, giving maybe 20 grams at a time, but up to a total of 120 grams per day, which could be either for using it as a diuretic for heart failure or for inflammation of the brain when the brain is holding too much water because of a disturbance of the antidiuretic hormone or vasopressin, or in treating cancer. So 20 or 30 grams at a time can also be given orally and is well absorbed and circulates systemically, so it doesn't have to be intravenous. And if it is used intravenously, it has to be added to a physiological solution of sodium chloride or glucose, 5 or 10% solution of glucose, can have 30%, or not necessarily that amount, but it can have a full load of urea added to it.
So you're saying that you could do 20 to 30 grams a day, which is probably about a couple teaspoons?
Yeah, that much up to 120 grams.
And then you'd want to dissolve it in a little salt water?
Or fruit juice. The people recommending it for treating heart failure, they've had patients staying on it for years where the other diuretics were disturbing their mineral metabolism. They were very stable on using urea, and they recommended using about 20 grams at a time in a glass of fruit juice and doing that several times a day.
So that's probably like 2/3 of an ounce. And urea is a commonly available compound.
Very cheap.
Very inexpensive. And there's been lots of studies showing its benefit.
Okay, well, thanks for your call, caller. Dr. Pete, what I wanted to, if I could just briefly ask your opinion of the cause of breast cancer, then we can look at some of the strategies that people can employ to negate that or prevent it.
The standard opinion is that it's a genetic thing,
right,
either inherited or occurring randomly. The evidence is just overwhelming against that the genetic problems almost always develop after the cancer is in progress. The overstimulation and undersupply of energy to the cell keeps the DNA from being repaired. The stress causes the mutation rather than the mutation causing the cancer. But the inherited genes, such as what's it called, BRCA?
Right.
I think.
BRCA1 and 2.
Yeah. That is simply an indication that the person is more sensitive to stress and to estrogen toxic effects. The anti-estrogen programs are more important, more effective for protecting them.
Okay. All right. Well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor, KMED, Garberville, 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show, 8 o'clock, we're inviting callers to ask questions or contribute with whatever they are experiencing with, if they have questions for Dr. Pete, around tonight's subject of breast cancer. Numbers 923-3911 if you're in the area, or there's an 800 number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. It's 1-800-568-3723. So Dr. Pete, let's quickly look at a strategy, a lifelong strategy, if you like. It's never too late to change. Some people leave it to the last minute. Some people get on board fairly quickly. But in terms of the strategy to prevent that likelihood of occurring, given that you're saying it's very much stress-related and the effects of stress, probably bringing in things like nitric oxide and estrogen directly increased in stress, how would you look at best avoiding that?
When you look at stress, the falling blood sugar and rising lactic acid are universal features of stress. And it happens that lactic acid is the main signal for producing the endorphins, the endogenous opiates. And if you look at the effects of stress, they're very closely all down the line associated with an excess and a prolonged production of the endogenous opiates. And everything that is uncomfortable will increase your tendency to overproduce lactic acid, hyperventilating, for example, from anxiety. When your carbon dioxide goes down, your lactic acid goes up. And strangely, the endorphins didn't get any of the bad connotations of morphine.
Well, I know. I mean, you hear the word endorphin and you think, gosh, it's good.
Yeah. A study at the University of California in San Diego, in the, I think it was dermatology department, they were experimentally giving people massages and measuring their various stress hormones. They saw that massaging lowered the beta endorphin. And everything, pain or overexertion, anything that interferes with the energy supply will increase the opiates or endorphins.
So you would think that having a massage would increase your endorphins when
it's the opposite.
In reality, of course, it's the opposite of what you're told.
Because endorphins are not good. Okay. All right. Can I move on to the aromatase inhibitors that are, I think, have become...
Well, I think what Dr. Pete was trying to get to there is that the low-dose naltrexone is being used therapeutically by a lot of doctors, and it's very useful because it lowers those endorphins that are so harmful, those endogenous opiates your body produces naturally that can be harmful in times of stress.
And everything you do that's good, pleasure such as the massage, will... have that same effect of protecting you against the endorphins and nitric oxide. So the naloxone or naltrexone low-dose treatment has a wide range of anti-stress effects, including protection against promotion of cancer.
And the happy factor, too, right?
Serotonin... And endorphins are often called the happy hormones, but actually they are the most important mediators of stress. And downstream, even though estrogen turns on lactic acid and endorphins and nitric oxide, the endorphins in turn activate estrogen receptors, aromatase, prolactin, which acts as an amplifier of estrogen's effect. You get this back and forth action, increasing inflammation, estrogenicity, and lowering energy production.
Wow. Incredible. So what can we do, Dr. Pete, to lower this estrogen with our diet?
Foods that naturally contain anti-aromatases, I think, are very important. I always mention orange juice and guavas, but there are lots of fruits and vegetables that contain similar chemicals.
So the naringenin is found in orange juice, but also in higher levels in the skins. Is that what you were saying, Dr. Pete?
Oh, yeah.
The orange is the skin, orange skin.
Both the juice and the peeling contain the protective things. So marmalade is another source of protective substances.
Anti-estrogen, breast cancer preventative compound.
Mm-hmm.
And then what about apigenin? That's another aromatase inhibitor that you were mentioning.
I think guavas and celery and parsley are... highest sources of that.
Okay, and COX-2 inhibitors were another rationale for blocking aromatase.
Aspirin, for about 20 years, I've been mentioning aspirin as probably the safest first thing that anyone who worries about breast cancer should start. It is... a very effective way to turn off estrogen production and response to estrogen.
And how much a day would you recommend?
The people with aggressive cancer probably should take 4 to 6 grams, and in that case, they also need to take vitamin K to prevent a bleeding problem.
Hmm. Yeah, up until I had a patient who was taking 6 grams of aspirin a day, and they just started to get the ear ringing. So up until that point where you get the ear ringing, then you know you're at the maximum and you want to back off just slightly till you don't get that ear ringing. But you have to use a milligram, not a microgram, but a milligram of vitamin K for every normal standard aspirin tablet, which is 325 milligrams.
I just wanted to bring out a couple of plant-based aromatase inhibitors that I know we were taught about when we were studying. Mistletoe. Mistletoe has been shown to be a aromatase inhibitor, and I know work was done with cancer, probably for that same reason, or maybe inadvertently they figured that it was helpful, probably through a estrogen blocking activity. Well, do you know much about mistletoe and its how it would physiologically how you would rationalize it?
About 50 years ago, I ran into some anthroposophy mm-hmm. people who got me interested in it, and so I've followed the research on it, but I don't think anything very, very new has turned up.
Okay. Because the other things they mentioned were, and you did mention this last month, white button mushrooms. I think the brown button mushrooms are just the same kind of compounds, but there are aromatase inhibitors in white button mushrooms. And I know you mentioned a dose last month that would be a realistic dose as an aromatase inhibitor.
Yeah, the Chinese study found that the women who had at least 10 grams a day on average had extremely low cancer mortality, and especially if they had green tea too,
right.
Like 88% lower.
Okay, and then I think the last two things were coffee and
tea.
Coffee and green tea, yeah.
We and normal black tea too. I mean, they would all have the same compound.
Okay.
And there was a caller who called in about black cohosh, and that is an estrogenic herb, and I would not recommend that for treatment or use with patients with breast cancer. Or I would not recommend it to prevent breast cancer.
Okay. So people that are going through breast cancer treatment, and I don't mean to ask you about this because I know you're definitely not in favor of it, but the chemotherapy, radiotherapy approach to cancer, it's just not doing it, is it?
There's a website that I'm not sure what is available on it, but he has written some very good articles on the issue of when and whether to treat certain types of cancer. His name is Gershom Zajicek.
Oh, right. Okay.
Zajicek. And his accent, now that he has YouTube videos, it's hard to understand, so if you can find his written articles, they're quicker to get through. But from the time of Hippocrates, I think Hippocrates said that for internal cancer, patients who are not treated will last a long time, but those who are treated die quickly. And Gershom Zajicek makes a similar point. And 50 years ago, a Berkeley professor, Hardin Jones, did a study and clearly showed that the longer a person waits before treating a cancer, the longer they live.
Well, and also there was that study that showed 95% of people over the age of 50 had some form of abdominal cancer.
Yeah, at autopsy if they died before.
Yeah, if they died like in a car crash or for some other unrelated to cancer reason. And 95% of people do not die of cancer, so...
Another person said that looking at all of the organs, 100% of people by the age of 50 have diagnosable cancer somewhere.
Yeah. We do have a caller on the air, so let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air, and where are you from?
Garberville, here, downtown Garberville.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Thank you, gentlemen and lady, for your wisdom and your knowledge. I have a question about a while back, I thought I understood that in all the skunky vegetables, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, that kind of stuff, that there's a lot of estrogen in those vegetables naturally. Is that true?
They certainly contain lots of sulfur compounds. Dr. Pete, I think there is
so thyroid suppressive they allow estrogen to build up naturally in men and women, because men actually usually have a lot higher levels of estrogen than women. But are they directly estrogenic, Dr. Pete?
There are some studies in animals showing a direct estrogenic effect of DIM and its metabolite.
IP3.
Yeah.
Those are commonly touted as breast cancer preventative, endometrial cancer preventative compounds, and Dr. Pete just said that there's lots of studies showing that they can have estrogenic effects in and of themselves.
I would say that sometimes they probably do have good effects, but I would wait for more research on them.
Okay, well, I'm not going to worry about how many Brussels sprouts or cabbage I eat. And I want to thank you kindly for your wealth of information, Dr. Pete, over the years here. Thank you. Good night.
Well, if you're still listening, caller, you can cook your kale, which is the most nutritious out of all of them, very, very well, and cook it with lots of coconut oil, and you will reduce some of the thyroid suppressive effects.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So were you going to say anything, Dr. Pete?
Yeah, on the topic of stress and cancer, mm-hmm. About 15 or 20 years ago, Carl Simonton was in the news recommending emotional therapy or changing your attitude, visualizing, trying to have anything to reduce stress as a way to improve survival. He noticed that he was a radiation treater of cancer, and he noticed that with the same treatment, his patients who were cheerier lived longer. And later, a group at Stanford and UC Berkeley did a study in which one group of women with advanced breast cancer were given some kind of emotional counseling, mm-hmm. and a similar number was just treated in a standard way.
Okay.
The ones with the counseling lived twice as long.
Yeah. The mind-body connection is underestimated.
So it shows the mind controls all.
We do have another caller on the air, so let's take this call up. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from?
I always heard that, I think they call them cruciferous vegetables.
Right.
Like
yes, the brassicas and broccoli the same thing
and,
as the brassicas.
Cauliflower and cabbage were very anti-cancer and were good for you, and especially the colon. Now, I tend to like to eat a lot of raw cabbage in salad. Is it any better if you don't cook it or you do cook it? You say that it suppresses thyroid?
Yeah, it suppresses your basic energy currency of your body's ability to use oxygen. And if it's raw, it's very, very potent. Actual thyroid drugs used to treat hyperactive thyroid have the same exact compound that's in cabbage juice. So raw cabbage is particularly harmful to your energy metabolism of your body.
But leaves in general can stimulate the intestine, so it has a speedier transit, and that reduces the recycling of estrogen. The liver excretes estrogen in the bile, and if you have slow transit, tend to be constipated, then much of that estrogen is reabsorbed and circulates again in the body.
So in other words, if you do eat like something like cabbage, it can make everything move through your intestines more quickly.
Right, but there's safer things you can eat to get your intestines moving, like raw grated carrot. And you could eat spinach or chard that you cook with a little bit of baking soda, and that will get your intestines
moving.
Well,
what about raw foods? What about, I heard that, you know, that they have good enzymes in them. They help digest the cooked food. Like if you have, you know, salad with, carrots and cabbage and lettuce and, that sort of thing, that's good for you.
Dr. Pete?
There is always the risk that since humans can't digest cellulose at all, but bacteria can. The uncooked food is great for bacteria replication, but very poor for human nutrition. And so it's a risk and can cause...
Well, what about fresh fruit?
Well, fresh fruit doesn't have such high cellulose content.
Yeah, the low-fiber fruits are very good.
So, but you wouldn't, you don't think raw vegetables are good? I mean, I always thought...
Only raw carrot, because the bacteria can't digest the raw carrot fiber like they can...
But if everything, if it helps move through your intestines quickly...
Well, then that's why you choose the things that are safer to help your intestines move more quickly.
Well, then why do we keep hearing that one of the best things to eat to prevent cancer is the cruciferous vegetables?
Unfortunate misinformation.
Why do we keep hearing that HRT is supposed to be protective for your bones?
Why do we keep hearing that estrogen is good for you? Why do we keep hearing that sugar is bad for you? It's unfortunate. I think we have to call that the evening. But thank you so much for callers who called in. And thank you, Dr. Pete, for your time. I'll just let people know how to get hold of you. I think I just want to sum the show up by saying that what you've heard this evening, have a rethink about it, because you probably never really heard it before, and what you have heard is not the truth, and it's so easy.
Most likely.
It's so easy to get brainwashed by media and by companies producing product, that it's very important that you do your own research, because you will find the truth out there. And people like Dr. Pete have spent most of his life researching, either directly or looking at peer-reviewed papers and looking at the scientific evidence. So it's unfortunate we get bombarded, but we do have the ability to turn on the computer and do our own research. But just thanks once again for joining us with the show. His number, or rather his website, is www.raypeat.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T.